Good morning. This is Brad Lacey, pastor of First Baptist Church at Conshohocken, president of the Philadelphia Bible Society, and for this hour, host of The Great Message on Talk Radio 1210, WPHT. We are joined for the preponderance of the hour by Dr. Chad Stutz, a friend to this broadcast from last year. Dr. Stutz is the chairperson of the Department of English Literature and Linguistics at my alma mater of Gordon College on the North Shore of Boston in the town of Wenham, Massachusetts. If you have ever sung the old hymn, My Jesus, I Love Thee, that is by A.J. Gordon, who is the founder of Gordon College. Dr. Stutz and I will share conversation concerning the great C.S. Lewis, but this after our homily, we draw upon the 21st chapter of Matthew and give focus to what we now give remembrance as Palm Sunday. Now, when they drew near to Jerusalem and came to Bethphage, to the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, Go into the village in front of you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, you shall say, The Lord needs them, and he will send them at once. This took place to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, saying, Say to the daughter of Zion, Behold, your king is coming to you, humble and mounted on a donkey, and on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. The disciples went and did as Jesus had directed them. They brought the donkey and the colt and put on them their cloaks, and he sat on them. Most of the crowd spread their cloaks on the road, and others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. And the crowds that went before him and that followed him were shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord! Hosanna in the highest! And when he entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred up, saying, Who is this? And the crowd said, This is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth of Galilee. And Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who sold and bought in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. He said to them, It is written, My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying out in the temple, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were indignant, and they said to him, Do you hear what they are saying? And Jesus said to them, Yes, have you never read? Out of the mouth of infants and nursing babes, you have prepared praise. And leaving them, he went out of the city to Bethany and lodged there. In the morning, as he was returning to the city, he became hungry. And seeing a fig tree by the wayside, he went to it and found nothing on it but only leaves. And he said to it, May no fruit ever come from you again. And the fig tree withered at once. When the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, How did the fig tree wither at once? And Jesus answered them, Truly, I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what has been done to the fig tree, but even if you say to this mountain, Be taken up and thrown into the sea, it will happen. And whatever you ask in prayer, you shall receive, if you have faith. What strikes me about this passage is that Jesus, in his person, if you will, is confronting several scenarios. Most recently to the text, he was confronting the scenario of obstruction, obstruction to genuine faith, obstruction to spiritual maturity and growth, oftentimes external to those who are seeking a deepening walk with the Lord. He went up against as well the money changer tables in the temple, a man who was the purest of the pure, who had a heart for his father. Indeed, we know by virtue of his later testament in the Gospel of John. I shouldn't say later, forgive me. But we know that he deemed himself to be one with the Father. And this is the predicate to Christian teaching down through the centuries. So very God of very gods is entering the temple, which is a place designed to be a place of prayer and of worship and of encounter with the Most High God. And there's all kinds of fleshly pursuits playing out within that temple precinct, and it is utterly insidious to Christ. And then as he enters Jerusalem, and here we begin, if you will, with the homily proper, apart from the reading and being spawned of the reading. Jesus is entering the city, but he's not entering in any prestigious way. You know, I remember being in downtown Moscow after the wall had come down back in the mid-90s. It was a Saturday afternoon. I was on the main thoroughfare, and a cavalcade of cars came down through the center section of the thoroughfare. We have nothing like that here in the States other than South Broad Street in Philadelphia, where our friends who live there park in the middle of South Broad Street. But here the cars were traveling, and I instinctively understood who it was. It was the president of the Soviet Union, or what was the Soviet Union, Boris Yeltsin. I couldn't see through the darkened windows, but the young man who was with me gave me assurance that I was correct. And all of the leading Russian dignitaries, notwithstanding the fact that they now ostensibly represented democracy, they were traveling in very impressive Lincoln Continentals and the like. And my young friend and I, representing the gospel, were on foot, taking bus and a metro train. You know, the world has its ways, and the leaders and rulers and the elites of this world, I don't begrudge them. They travel in mighty and prestigious fashion. But the Son of God, he doesn't ride in on a Clydesdale. He isn't brought in a Lincoln Continental as presidents are. He is sitting on a donkey and on a colt, which ostensibly sounds reasonably impressive. I think of a sleek young black colt running through territory as men are trying to break him or her. But the colt was actually the foal of a beast of burden. And so Jesus is entering the most prestigious city in the world in a very unprestigious way. This speaks, of course, to his humility of character. I love what Paul has to say in the letter to the Philippians, the second chapter, that he who was in nature God did not in any way consider equality with God something to be grasped or to take advantage of. Instead, we read that Jesus humbled himself. He humbled himself by taking the form of a man, and not simply that of a man, but of a servant. And not simply that of a servant, but as one who would go to the cross in our stead. He enters the most prestigious city in the world in the most unprestigious and in the most humble of ways. And yet the people flock to him. The reality is that in that day and age, at least in the immediate, in the fleshly way, Jesus Christ was probably the closest approximate in that day to the rock stars that we have today. Word would have traveled like wildfire throughout Israel of this one who had come and who had challenged religious elites, who healed the sick and fed the hungry. He was sexually pure. How many of those religious elites were sleeping with the likes of Mary Magdalene? But Jesus was sexually pure. There would have been no gossip floating around about Christ and his lack of purity. There was nothing to hang that kind of hat on. So Christ was well received in the immediate. The people knew that he was in their corner. He knew that he delighted to help them. What they didn't reckon with was the corruption of their own hearts, because as they welcome him in the immediate, the sad and traumatic reality is that within a matter of another day or so, they would forsake him and hand him over in favor of a murderer by the name of Barabbas. A very, very, an ultimate travesty, to be sure. But Christ comes in humbly, but he also rides in and he confronts the realities of the temple with a moral authority. He didn't require anything prestigious for that moral and spiritual authority to speak forth powerfully. It was the very nature of his person. And everyone would have to defer to him, at least in the immediate. And this is something I think we need to understand as members of the Church of Jesus Christ. We don't need fancy anything. We don't need the best. We need to be morally pure, spiritually pure. We need to be in the presence of God, which means that we are, by virtue of the shed blood of the Savior, holy. And that moral and spiritual purity will speak powerfully to an increasingly corrupt and depraved and darkened world. The Church, not simply the Catholic Church of 20 years ago with the pedophilia scandal, alas, but the Evangelical Church as well, and the mainline Church as well. We all have lost that luster of moral and spiritual purity. It can, by God's grace, be regained, but we must bow before him as the people did on the road as he entered Jerusalem. And we must bow before him as in the end result, we know that before the name of Christ, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. This is the message, please, of Palm Sunday. God bless you as you receive it. Brad Lacey with the great message. We return in a moment. Thank you. Brad Lacey returning with the great message on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. It is my consummate pleasure to be rejoined today by Dr. Chad Stutz. Dr. Stutz has been with us twice before on this broadcast. Last fall, I had the great privilege of sharing lunch with him on the campus of my alma mater. Dr. Stutz is the chairperson of the Department of English Literature and Linguistics at my alma mater of Gordon College on the North Shore of Boston, Massachusetts. And he's not simply the chairperson of the Department of English Literature and Linguistics. He's just one pleasant, affable, nice guy. And Dr. Stutz, we're so pleased to have you back.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here. It's great to see you again.
Well, praise God. I was thrilled beyond measure when I learned, even envious of the students, because this wasn't available to me in my day. But you have been conducting a course of an examination of G.K. Chesterton, the great Anglo-Catholic, and C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
That's an incomparable pairing. And I'm just, before we even enter into the life of C.S. Lewis, I'm just curious, you must be just enjoying this course to the nines yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's been one of the best classes that I've had in a long time. And the students are great, which always makes it easy. But great, just great material. We've had some wonderful discussions about Chesterton and Lewis. So lots of fun for sure.
Oh, I wish I could be up there to audit. When we come to the final segment, I want to talk about the state of Lewis before academia today. We'll touch upon that. I doubt it's not anything to write home about, alas, but we'll discuss it. But in the immediate, Dr. Stutz, would you share for our audience the life of C.S. Lewis? What is it that brought him to such a place that he became the guru of so many Christians?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big thing about Lewis, right, and it's always hard to kind of summarize a life quickly, but I think one of the things that just stands out is, you know, he began as a young boy in Belfast, Ireland, kind of in what he himself sort of describes in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, as a kind of conventional Christianity. Right. And then sort of, went off to school. His mother passed away, kind of had a distant relationship with his father, goes off to school in England and Ireland, and sort of through that process, really lost his faith around the age of 15. So had a kind of deconversion experience, becomes an avowed atheist for a while, but then gradually really begins to kind of journey back towards Christianity. And of course, he was helped along in different ways by reading Chesterton, for example, reading his essays, reading The Everlasting Man, obviously good friendships with people like J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. That all kind of played a role in his thinking.
If I may, had Lewis ever met Chesterton?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I think it was,
nor I.
Right. I think it was purely just sort of coming to his readings, right? And gradually, as he kind of describes it, Surprised by Joy, sort of comes to the conclusion that he might be one of the saner people in England at the time, right? Even though many people were kind of writing Chesterton off. So it's really friendships, I think, in many ways. And then, of course, you know, he's such a bright intellect, just kind of thinking through a lot of the sort of challenges to Christianity, but eventually comes back around and in a really famous sort of moment with Tolkien and Hugo Dyson and Addison's Walk, right, in Magdalen College.
Yes, at Oxford, right.
That's right, yeah. In 1931, you know, eventually converts to Christianity, or reconverts, I guess you could say. And I think it's that sort of trajectory, right, that has really made Lewis compelling, right? This really incredibly bright intellectual who's also a serious Christian, has thought through, you know, a lot of the common objections, and yet is nevertheless a committed believer. And I think that's just spoken to so many people within the church over the years.
Isn't there also a rather famous anecdote in the life of Lewis? I take it more symbolic than literal, in the sense that he was in a sidecar, one of those classic motorcycles with sidecars,
right,
and something to the effect, he said, when he got into the sidecar, he was an agnostic. By the end of the trip, he gets out and he's a believer. He's
right.
I tend to treat that, it actually happened, but I tend to treat the process more symbolically, you know.
Right. No, that's right. And, you know, he also describes himself sort of famously as the most reluctant convert in all England, right? And it's a very arduous journey for him, right? One that he sort of narrates with great pathos in Surprised by Joy. It's not an uncommon story, right? I mean, I think that it's a story that Christians can relate to, but it has its own sort of interesting twists and turns, right? And it's a compelling narrative. Like I said, I think it's that conversion, I think, that really has interested people in Lewis for so many years.
And also, you speak of his friendships with the likes of Tolkien, of Lord of the Rings fame, a lesser known to the public, Hugo Dyson. Mm-hmm. He had a great capacity for friendship, didn't he? He seemed to revel in the company of his friends.
He did, right. And, you know, for somebody who was really a bachelor for the majority of his life, you could see how those friendships would be vital to him. But, he talks about friendship in so many different places in his writings, and just the role that they played for him intellectually, spiritually, emotionally. Obviously, you know, he's famous for being part of the Inklings and just that intellectual group that met in Oxford on a regular basis and sort of exchanged ideas, challenged one another. So friendship was central to Lewis in so many ways.
When my wife and I, my late wife, we visited Oxford back in the fall of 2006, we had the privilege of having lunch at the Eagle and Child,
right,
one of the pubs where these guys frequented. My understanding is that that's shut down now. I'm hoping not permanently.
Yeah, in fact, I was actually in Oxford last May, and we walked by it, and it was indeed, unfortunately, shut down. I'd visited there in college when it was open, but it was not reopened yet. So I'm like you, I'm hoping it will be.
to be sure. What a beautiful place. What a beautiful place. What was Lewis like? I mean, we can speak of his capacity for friendship. What was he like? What was his personality?
Yeah, I mean, I think Lewis really, you know, he enjoyed life, I think, right? I mean, he, you know, obviously loved a good drink and loved a good smoke and things that sometimes, you know, we sort of look askance at. But I think he was, you know, he was willing to embrace those pleasures. We've talked about the pleasures of friendship. My understanding, you know, from the things that I've read and the things that I've sort of heard is he could also be a pretty stern tutor, right? I mean, in his role as tutor at Oxford and later professor at Cambridge, you know, he definitely, I think, appreciated and valued sharp intellectual thinking and was not afraid to challenge his students. But I think he was a very humble guy at the same time. And, you know, when you read Lewis, you almost get the sense that that's one of the things that he's acutely aware of, right, is the temptation, you know, given all of his success and his publicity and things like that. I think he was always aware of the pitfall of arrogance, of pride. And so, you know, he really worked hard to practice that humility. And that, I think, was a keynote with him.
Well, when we come to our final section together, alas, it will come very quickly. I want to read something. I've always been enamored of a poem, a short poem that he wrote. And I believe it's called The Apologist's Evening Prayer. And in that poem, he's very, very mindful of the proclivity towards pride and arrogance. And taking a sense of triumphalism over and against an opponent in debate. So, yes, I this is my impression of Lewis as well. I think he had a great sense of humor, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely, right, which I think comes out. In his writings.
He loved practical jokes.
Absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely, yes.
Sadly, however, he wasn't necessarily greatly loved by many of his colleagues, if only because he was a devout Christian.
That's right.
And they were quite the opposite.
That's right. Yeah. And in fact, that's partly why he ended up eventually having to move from Oxford to Cambridge, is they really wouldn't sort of recognize his achievements because they had been, you know, so religiously motivated in a sense. And Cambridge took him. Oxford didn't want him anymore. So, yeah, he did, in a sense, suffer for that in a way.
It's very, very sad. But of course, Lewis would, I mean, there was a kind of triumph to his life. Nothing was going to stop the use of God. God's use of him, you know, praise the Lord. Dr. Stutz, we must take a break. Brad Lacey and Dr. Chad Stutz, we will return with the great message in just a moment. Brad Lacey and Dr. Chad Stutz, chairperson of the Department of English Literature and Linguistics of my alma mater of Gorton College on the North Shore of Boston. We return for another round of the great message on Talk Radio 1210. WPHT. Dr. Stutz, as we move deeper into the area of C.S. Lewis, what is Lewis's significance? I remember when I got to Gorton, I didn't know who he was. That was 1979. I didn't know who he was, and everybody was talking about him. I mean, he didn't play first base for the Boston Red Sox. You know, he wasn't a character in Marvel Comics. What good was he? He wasn't even a character on the NBC soap opera Another World. So what made C.S. Lewis so significant?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, in some ways he was significant to different audiences in different ways. I mean, he was, even despite the fact that we were sort of mentioning earlier, he was eventually kind of shuffled out of Oxford. He was a very prominent, recognized scholar. I mean, one of his first scholarly works, The Allegory of Love, is something still people turn to even now, right? When they're sort of trying to understand the courtly love tradition and allegory. So that's not to diminish at all his very real scholarly standing. Kind of in the mid-20th century.
I have a number of his scholarly works. They're all impeccable.
Right. No, they're fantastic works. And they've sort of held on, like I said, even now. At the same time, I remember a kind of similar experience, coming to college, like the one you just described. And what I've found, this is certainly true for me, and I think it's true for a lot of my students as well, is he in some ways represents a kind of aspiration for Christians that take seriously the life of the mind, right? I mean, I think he really found a way to bring together his Christian faith without sacrificing any of the core doctrines of that faith, right? But to really defend that faith in a thoughtful way that interacted with sort of what was going on around him at the time. And so I find my students gravitating towards him just as a model, right, for their own sort of intellectual journey, their intellectual life. And I think, too, the thing, he's just a fantastic writer. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've been reminded of. We just started reading his novel Perelander this week.
Oh, yes.
The second of the space trilogy. And I was sort of saying to my students, I always forget how much I love that novel just for his ability just to bring alive in vivid, imaginative ways, life on other planets and things like that. So there's just a kind of glory to his writing, honestly, that touches one emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. So I think he's significant for a variety of reasons, but those are the big ones for me.
And what I would also suggest, you speak of him being a model for the life of the mind. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I would simply add, and I'm sure you will agree with me, that the cerebral quality to his work had hands and feet to it. It's not simply cerebral. It has practical application.
That's right.
You know? Yeah.
Yep.
That's hard to find.
It is. And it's funny. I agree with that 100%. But I mean, I think when I sort of describe for people like my favorite Christian writers throughout history, I'll often mention Augustine, Jonathan Edwards and Lewis. And I've kind of thought about them over the years and sort of what they have in common. And for me, it's exactly what you were saying. It's that ability to bring deep intellect to the table, but also to present it in a way that resonates emotionally, right? There's intellect and feeling in this interesting synergy that you just don't find in other writers.
It's holistic.
Right, right.
You know,
exactly.
By the way, I would add the metaphysical poet George Herbert to your list.
Correct. Agree.
Yes,
he's great.
I love Herbert. I love Herbert.
Absolutely.
What are some of the seminal ideas or trains of thought that come with Lewis?
Yeah. One of the big ones that stands out to me, and this is something that we've been circling back to in all sorts of ways in my class this semester, is that whole idea of joy and desire, right? I mean, that's central to Lewis's thought. You know, he sort of puts forward a rather famous argument in Mere Christianity, you know, the kind of argument from desire that if we have you know, desire for bread, it must mean that there's real food out there somewhere. You know, if we have a desire for something beyond this world, you know, it's only logical to conclude that there is something beyond this world that will meet that desire. And of course, for Lewis, that's God. But that sort of idea of desire, longing, joy, this kind of almost, I don't know, stabbing pain that you get that you sort of want back, right? I think just shows up all over the place. Obviously, in Surprised by Joy, that's kind of central to the narrative, but it shows up all over his novels and in Narnia and all kinds of places. So for me, that's always been a big one. And I think it's one of the things that's attracted me to Lewis, because as we were sort of alluding to a moment ago, not only does he talk about it in an intellectual way, but I think in his novels and his fiction, he actually recreates that experience for us as readers and gives us a sense of what that feels like.
Along with joy and desire, part and parcel of that, he seems to have a deep inroad into the reality of love.
Yes, yes, absolutely, right. And, you know, he talks about that in Mere Christianity, of course, sort of Christian charity. But, I mean, I think he develops that idea most fully in his book, The Four Loves, right, where he's really able to sort of parse distinctions there. But yeah, I mean, I think he stands in the best of the Christian tradition when he really sees charity as the chief virtue, right? He's very Pauline in that sense. And that's something that comes out. I mean, I'm even thinking now in Perelandra, right? The whole Eldil, the Oyarsa of Perelandra really is a kind of exemplification of charity. In fact, he describes her that way to a great extent, a terrible charity, interestingly enough, but a very real embodiment of that key virtue for us as Christians.
There's a line in one of his writings, and forgive me, I don't have the writing at hand. Something along the lines, he speaks of the love of God being severe, and he compares it to that of the jealousy of a mistress or of a man's dog. Mm. It was just such a compelling thought.
Right, right.
Yeah, I loved it. I positively loved it.
Right, right. And of course, you're actually indirectly touching on one of Lewis's other great gifts, which is just to use some really, really great analogies to drive home a point. Right. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's sort of one of his stylistic virtues. But yeah.
Now, Dr. Stutz, you and I are part and parcel of an evangelical tradition. Many of the people listening to this broadcast would be a part of a more Catholic tradition. Right. Lewis didn't really fit either mold, did he? I mean, though we love him as evangelicals, I'm not certain he would be comfortable with us.
Right, right. Yes, that's, in fact, I mean, he more or less identified, you know, throughout his adult life, you know, sort of post-conversion as an Orthodox Anglican. And even, I think, kind of had some leanings a little bit more in the high church direction. But, you know, the heart of Lewis's kind of project, if you will, as an apologist, of course, is that whole idea of Mere Christianity, which he in a lot of ways borrows from Chesterton. Right. I mean, I think what he was really wanting to do is to focus Christians' attention on the doctrines that we have in common, something that I think it's easy to forget. Right. Amid all of the schisms and things like that. And to defend what really has been the core of the faith for 2000 years. So he was really, I think, trying in many ways, not only to defend the faith, but to draw Christians together and remind us what we have in common.
I would also bring forth, I remember when I first read it, it was very much, for me, the Gospel of Matthew, when in my early days as a believer, when I first encountered George Eliot's Middlemarch. When I use the word revelation, I don't mean in the same sense as the Bible, but it was revelatory to me. When I encountered Lewis's essay entitled The Weight of Glory, I was stunned by this essay, stunned by the profundity, by the imagery. He talks about how if you know, in eternity, if you will, every individual we know now will either tower before us with such majesty and righteousness and the like that we'll want to bow before him or her, or will be the person will be so disfigured and defaced, will be just sickened. I mean, it's all imagery, I understand, but how powerfully he brought forth the issue of our eternal destiny.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm so glad you mentioned that essay, because, you know, when people ask me what's your favorite Lewis, it's always a hard question to answer. But I'll often say it's the Weight of Glory essay. I mean, I think that's the pinnacle in many ways of his, you know, achievement, certainly as an essayist. But yeah, what strikes me about that particular piece always is, and it kind of piggybacks on what you were saying, the very end of that essay, where he's sort of reminding us that every person we encounter every single day is a soul that is either on the way to heaven or on the way to hell, right? And really sort of invites us to think about what are the implications for us? What does that mean for the way we treat people, the way we share the gospel with people? That's a compelling moment, right? I'm always sort of convicted when I read through that essay and come to that point. So yeah, that's one of my favorites.
And within 45 seconds, another interesting dimension to Lewis was his relationship with women, because there were two in particular. Right. There was the older lady. We don't really know.
Mrs. Moore.
Yeah. We don't really know whether they were sexually involved.
Right.
I suspect they were, but I don't know.
Yeah, right.
And then there's the woman who became his wife. She was a very feisty Jewish poetess, I think. Very feisty. And he adored her.
Right.
You know, these were rather unconventional relationships.
Right. And that, as you might imagine, there's been a lot of ink spilled over the years, just sort of speculating about the nature of those relationships. Yeah. And it's unclear, I think, in many respects. But that is a fascinating chapter.
Ultimately, clearly, he was more comfortable. This doesn't make him homosexual with every respect, but he was more comfortable with men. That is clear, you know.
Right. Absolutely.
Dr. Stutz, one more round ahead. Brad Lacey and Dr. Chad Stutz, we return with the great message in just a moment. Brad Lacey and Dr. Chad Stutz returning for one final round of The Great Message on Talk Radio 1210, WPHT. Dr. Chad Stutz, again, is the chairperson of the Department of English Literature and Linguistics of my alma mater of Gordon College on the North Shore of Boston. Dr. Stutz and I shared a lovely lunch together back in the autumn of last year when I was visiting campus. He's truly a very dear and fine man. You'd love his third floor study in Frost Hall, as did I. But Dr. Stutz, I'd like to read something very brief to you. This is called The Apologist's Evening Prayer by Lewis himself. The first time I read this, I was so impressed. From all my lame defeats and oh much more, from all the victories that I seem to score, from cleverness shot forth on thy behalf, at which, while angels weep, the audience laugh. From all my proofs of thy divinity, thou who wouldst give no sign, deliver me. Thoughts are but coins. Let me not trust, instead of thee, their thin-worn image of thy head. From all my thoughts, even from my thoughts of thee, O thou fair silence, fall and set me free. I love this next line. Lord of the narrow gate and the needle's eye, take from me all my trumpery, lest I die. Wouldn't you love the talking heads on cable news networks to read this poem, you know? And I like some of those guys, don't get me wrong, but wouldn't you love them to read that? That's one of my favorites. What are some of your favorite pieces of Lewis?
Yes. So I already mentioned the Weight of Glory. I think that's probably my favorite. I love, probably my favorite novel is also the one I mentioned, Perelandra, which is, of course, a kind of interaction with Milton. It's a retelling of the fall narrative in a slightly different context.
If I may interject, one of the other novels in that three-part sequence I was listening to an interview betwixt Eric Metaxas and Dr. Tom Howard.
Oh, right. Yes.
And they both mentioned one of the other novels in that sci-fi series, if you will, as being a work of sheer brilliance. Which one would that be?
I'm guessing that Hideous Strength. Is that the
that one? That was it.
Right.
That was it.
Yes,
yeah.
That's the third one. Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Great, great novel. I personally don't resonate quite as much with that one. Paralandra, I think, is a little bit more of a self-contained novel, if you will.
Yes.
It's kind of a complete narrative. But I love that Hideous Strength. I mean, it certainly is very prescient in sort of its anticipation of some, you know, totalitarian and authoritarian sort of movements and things like that.
Yes.
So very interesting.
And of course, Lewis owns the hearts and minds of so many children and adults with the Narnia sequence.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, that for me, that was my first introduction to Lewis. Was my mom read the entire Narnia series to my sister and I when we were very young. And we did the same for my two older children. And the last time I was reading through it, I mean, it was one of those things that my wife and I were very literally in tears at point. I think that's just, again, speaks to Lewis's ability just to grab our imaginations.
Yes. And what about,
I love Narnia.
And what about some of his apologetic work?
Yes. So I mean, I love Mere Christianity. I've taught that this semester. That was one of the texts that we did earlier in the semester. And I always love revisiting that. I've sometimes described Lewis to people as somebody who just makes sense. I don't know if there's a better way to say it, but it's that feeling of coming to, you know, to the truths of Christianity, and you're just sort of like, yeah, that's right. I totally understand it.
Well, there's something to the English line of philosophical thinking. I mean, the Germans are the great idealists, you know.
Right.
The Brits have that commonsensical foundation, and
it's
Lewis
true.
Is a part of that, isn't he?
Absolutely. Right. And I think he's also, you know, he's getting a lot of that, especially stylistically from Chesterton, which that's an interesting connection. But I mean, just that ability, as we were talking earlier, to turn a phrase or to offer a really timely analogy to drive home a point. But yeah, I mean, the thing I love about Lewis is he's just so clear in his thinking. And, and you know, that's something he demanded from his students. So it's no surprise that he exemplifies it himself.
Also, The Four Loves is one of his classics.
Yes, yes. And it's actually been a little while since I've read that one, but that's one that I also appreciate. I actually, this one sometimes, you know, doesn't get quite as much airtime, but I really appreciated The Problem of Pain when I read that text for the first time. I mean, it really helped me to kind of think through that problem of suffering, which is an important one, you know.
Dr. Stutz is a man who 4 years ago in June underwent life-threatening surgery at the Mayo Clinic for cardiac issues, and then upon return from successful surgery, I nearly died by way of reactions.
Wow.
And then last year, ministering to my wife, who was being devoured by pancreatic cancer, Lewis's volume is quite apropos of reality.
Yes.
There's no question. How about, you know, the one that I found to be very tough, and I can read tough stuff, all right? I do. I'm known for reading tough stuff. But I have to be honest with you, Miracles was brutal. Everybody thinks we can turn to miracles and read about the miraculous.
Right.
And it's a miracle if you can get through that.
It's true. Amen to that. Yeah, no, I read that when I was in grad school and had a very, very similar experience. So you're not alone. That's one that I honestly, it's on my shelf and I keep thinking I need to go back to that one and give it another try. But I had a very similar reaction when I read it.
Please, this is meant solely in a humorous way. I'm not encouraging anyone to drink. But I would suggest a bottle of tequila by your side.
Right,
if you're gonna, you know what I'm saying? Hey, I made reference earlier on, but men like you and I love Lewis, but what is the state of Lewis in the academy today? Is he being drawn upon at all outside of evangelical institutions?
Yeah, you know, I don't think, you know, I think the state of literary scholarship, right, which is, I was sort of saying earlier, was something he was recognized for in his time, and had a lot of appeal in that regard. I think, unfortunately, literary scholarship has moved in a direction that has kind of left not only Lewis, but those who are thinking in a similar vein kind of in the dust.
It's all very deconstructionist
it is.
Now,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, very, very much sort of rooted in critical theory and things that are not really, you know, they don't gel well with sort of the approach that Lewis was trying to take. So in that regard, you know, I don't think a lot of people are looking to him for scholarly insights. Again, the exception there might be something like The Allegory of Love. I still think that's a classic study, as I said earlier, in the courtly love tradition. But beyond that, you know, there's quite the kind of niche industry, I guess you could say, of people studying Lewis. You know, articles are being published all the time. Books are being published all the time. In other words, he remains a source of fascination for scholars in the academy, both Christian and non-Christian, quite honestly, today. So that's alive and well.
Well, I will tell you that the film actor, David Morse, was interviewed in the New York Times last year. And C.S. Lewis was instrumental in bringing him back to faith.
Interesting. Right, right.
You know, Morse talks about having daily devotions every day for years now. And Lewis had such an influential role. I just want to leave you with this. I love when Lewis was dying. I believe it was to his brother or maybe to Walter Hooper, one of those guys. Yeah. He said that, you know, he was ready to die. Do you know why? He says, I've read everything there is to read.
If only I could say that, right? Yeah.
No, I love it. Dr. Stutz, I want to bring you back to talk about G.K. Chesterton. Will you come back?
Absolutely. I would love to. Yes.
Well, then you know you'll be invited back. I'm so grateful for your time today, sir. Dr. Chad Stutz, the chairperson of the Department of English Literature and Linguistics of Gordon College. This is Brad Lacey. On behalf of the two of us, we bid you God's blessing. Thank you.